Hello everybody and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 337. This week the questions are taken from guide 411 on the King George V class super dreadnoughts of World War I and the Wednesday video on Admiral Spruance covering his career from the Marshall Islands campaign to the Great Marianas turkey shoot. So with that said, let's get on with questions. Brendan Buersdorf asks, why was the Japanese seaplane carrier Nishin armed with 640mm guns in twin turrets? This seems like an extremely substantial anti-surface armament for a ship that's never supposed to be anywhere near the front lines. Was it supposed to operate as a sort of escort cruiser as well, given this armament is almost the same as the Agano-class light cruisers? As far as I can tell, it seems to be kind of half and half. So the Japanese seaplane tenders as a whole are generally viewed to be the next stage of what the Japanese had attempted with Ryūzhou. So with Ryūzhou, they'd attempted to build a small aircraft carrier that was under the 10,000 ton limit, which was the lower floor of what was considered an aircraft carrier in the Washington Treaty and thus fall outside of the treaty. But when that loophole was closed up by the London Naval Treaty of 1930, they seem to have moved on to various seaplane carriers because, again, seaplane carriers fell outside of the primary restrictions of the naval treaty system. But the idea was ostensibly to be able to quickly convert these seaplane tenders into small aircraft carriers very rapidly in the event of the outbreak of war. As it turned out, only about half of the seaplane tenders were turned into small aircraft carriers because it turned out it actually took a lot more work than they thought. But with that said, the facilities that they installed on the seaplane carriers do kind of put them as a general purpose type of vessel. Now, the slightly odd thing is that the previous seaplane carriers or seaplane tenders tended to carry 127mm or 5-inch guns, which were actually dual purpose. The 140mm on Nishin are not dual purpose. They've got a maximum elevation of 35 degrees. So, as you say, they're kind of more like light cruiser guns than they are a dual-purpose armament, which, you know, the dual-purpose would make sense because it's a seaplane carrier, but, you know, it's also carrying a forward battery of guns which can help defend it from potential air attack and maybe see off the odd destroyer as well. But the way the seaplane tenders seem to have been designed is that in, I guess, small, low-level conflicts or early on in the war before they can be hauled in for conversion, they seem to be designed as very general-purpose ships. So, yes, they can carry and launch seaplanes, but they also theoretically have the ability to launch planes with conventional landing gear, just not recover them. And they have to defend themselves, and there is a possibility they might be attacked by enemy surface warships, because they probably, as seaplane tenders, are not going to be operating with the main fleet, because they're a bit too slow for that. And, as it turned out, they were also used occasionally as transports, and given the sheer capacity of them, I'm sure that probably hadn't slipped the mind of Japanese planners in the first place, at which point they may have to defend themselves on transport runs. Possibly even, who knows, someone optimistically might have thought they could provide some sure fire support for troops if they were delivering close to the front lines. So I think, although they did have a separate purpose of turning them into small carriers in mind, I think the baseline design was probably trying to create this kind of general purpose support vessel for which an anti-surface armament was needed, and probably someone just got a little bit carried away designing the Nishin, which was, I think, the last of the big Japanese seaplane carriers, and forgot about the fact that it should also be able to defend itself from long-range air attacks. Scooter de Scooter asks, ship camouflage. Some schemes are boring, some are painful to gaze upon. Why and how did they come up with these design patterns? Broadly speaking, you can divide the purpose of ship camouflage into one of three categories, and they actually all kind of follow on one from the other. So the first category is, the ship isn't there. So this is the kind of camouflage which would be things like an all-grey or an all-blue scheme, or if you're operating near a lot of islands, perhaps an all-green scheme. And when I say all blue, all grey, all green, it doesn't necessarily have to be all the same shade. can be different shades because, of course, the hull is right near the water. In theory, the superstructure, especially if you're looking at a ship from a distance, which is where the camouflage is most likely to be effective, will probably be silhouetted against the sky. And so you might want a darker hull and a lighter upper works, for example. But if you decide for whatever reason that, you know, the ship isn't here, isn't going to work, then you can move on to the second stage, which is the ship is here, but you can't work out what it is. And this kind of camouflage will aim not so much to conceal that there is a ship, but to give you a false idea of what that ship could possibly be. So this would be things like perhaps disguising a merchant ship to look like a warship to persuade other warships that might be dissuaded then by the apparent size of said ship not to attack it. Or it could be disguising a warship to look like a merchant ship, perhaps if it's on a commerce raiding mission, to discourage warships from investigating and therefore potentially attacking it. Or it could be to, let's say, make a battleship look like a heavy cruiser, which might then tempt cruisers to come in and attack it, only to have the tables turned on them. Or vice versa, you might try and disguise a cruiser as a battleship to scare off anything that isn't a battleship, and then because you're a cruiser, if a battleship does turn up, then unless it's an Iowa, you can run away from it. And this could include things like, let's say, painting the bow and stern in very camouflage colours, if you like, so referring to point one, and then painting the amidship section, say the middle 80% of the ship, in a very strong contrasting colour, which will draw the eye and tend to cause the bow and stern to fade out, to perhaps give a false impression that a large ship is actually shorter. And you use the same thing for profiles. So you put in a very, very strong colour that indicates, and actually makes the ship quite visible, but indicates, you know, look at this. This is the thing I want you to see, and all the bits you don't want to see that could contradict that image, you paint in very pale, faint colours that hopefully match the surroundings, and then hopefully the observers won't see that, and they will think the ship is something else. And this has all sorts of variations. There are very, very complicated ways of doing this, and there are remarkably simple ways of doing this. It can just be as simple as, you know, well, stuff convincing them exactly what ship this is. We're just going to make it really difficult for them to focus on the ship. They know it's there, but all they can see is one thing. And so when you look at the British Pacific Fleet, for example, there's a camouflage, quote-unquote, scheme that they use for a little bit, which has a really, really strong, dark, rectangular band in the middle of the ship. The rest of the ship is very pale. And what that is going to do is, when you're trying to focus on it, your eye is naturally going to be drawn to this big block of really, really bold colour, and then it's going to make it very difficult to actually see anything other than the block of colour because of the way the human brain works for most people. And the last stage of camouflage is, well, yes, okay, you can see that it is a ship and you can see what kind of ship it is, but you can't tell what the ship is doing. And this kind of camouflage would be things like the famous dazzle camouflage. There's an example here on the pre-dreadnought USS New Jersey. And the idea of this is to say, yeah, okay, you can very much see the ship. In fact, this kind of camo might make it easier to spot the ship than even if it was just in a default paint scheme. But good luck working out from that observation what exactly it's doing. How fast is it going? What course is it on? Etc., etc. And dazzle camo was primarily about disrupting the idea of which direction the ship was going, because then that would obviously then predicate on where a submarine would launch its torpedoes, but on some warships, because some warships did have dazzle camo, but on other warships which had this kind of camouflage, it could be an evolution on the second type of camo. So that's where you might put a false bow wave on to give the impression the ship is going considerably faster than it actually is, which is obviously going to throw off your gunnery if you are relying on estimates of your target speed, for example. And as you might surmise from, you know, having seen ship camouflage before, you don't necessarily have to follow one of these three steps to the exclusion of the others. You can incorporate all of them. So there's fairly well-known German camouflage schemes, for example, that incorporate the you-can't-see-the-parts-of-the-ship element on the bow and stern, But there's also elements that are kind of, look at here, look, you're actually seeing an Admiral Hipper-sized vessel, so it's kind of element two. And there's also, with the zigzags and the false bow waves, also an element of, well, you might think you're seeing an Admiral Hipper class, but how fast is it going? What direction is it going? Do you really know? When in fact it's perhaps a Bismarck class going at a relatively pedestrian pace compared to what the false image that's being generated might suggest. Captain Seafort asks, the King George V's of World War I were the last British battleships with a 4-inch secondary battery. And depending on who you read, going up to the 6-inch on the Iron Dukes was either a good idea on the grounds that a single 4-inch hit couldn't stop a modern destroyer, or a bad one on the grounds that they were ineffective and they were an explosion or flooding risk. Do you think that overall going up to the 6-inch was a good idea or a bad one based on the information available at the time? I think at the time, on balance, I would side with probably just about a bad idea. And I would say that for two reasons. Firstly, it forces, because of the additional weight of the guns, it forces the secondary battery to be lowered a deck into casemates. Because you see here, this is Audacious, one of the King George V's. And you'll notice that the secondary battery is entirely within the superstructure, much like the 5-inch guns on most US standards. But then you look at the Iron Dukes, and the 6-inch battery has dropped down into the hull, and it's now in hull casemates, which actually are far more liable to be washed out, and therefore less able to be used in a wider range of sea states. And that's not necessarily a good thing, because, well, destroyers might come at you in all sorts of sea states. The other thing, which I think is a big disadvantage of the 6-inch guns, apart from the fact, obviously, they fire at a slightly slower rate, is that at the time the change is being made, not even all capital ships have fire control systems and rangefinders for their main battery, let alone their secondary battery. And without centralized fire control and, you know, the associated large rangefinders, the fact that the 6-inch gun can reach out further on paper than the 4-inch doesn't actually make that much difference, because you're not going to be able to exploit that additional range all that accurately. At which point, I think, having more guns that can fire a bit more rapidly, that are capable of engaging in more sea states, probably on balance is just about the better option. Because then, yeah, one hit might not stop the destroyer, but there's significantly better chances of you getting more than one hit. Now, not necessarily saying that the 4-inch is the thing they should have stuck with, and later on the Royal Navy would actually decide it rather liked the 5.5-inch, which was found on some Greek cruisers that they took over, but I think they should have stuck with a caliber that allowed them to maintain the guns in the superstructure. Once the weight got too heavy and it had to drop down into the hull and casemates, that, I think, was the step too far. Now, if you advance by half a decade or so to a point where you're starting to get secondary battery rangefinders and central fire control systems, then a lot of the objections start to get somewhat overruled, and the 6-inch battery begins to make a bit more sense, because now it's capable of exploiting that additional range. And in World War I, the range brackets between the 4-inch and the 6-inch are actually sitting in the area in which destroyers may or may not be able to either make an attack or at least begin their final attack run. So it does actually matter, but only later once those fire control systems are in place. I suppose the other thing you could say for the 6-inch battery is, because it's in the cull in armoured casements, you can run it pretty much the full length of the amidship section of the ship, which for the Iron Dukes is important because they have the amidship's Q turret. And so the 6-inch battery, although it is reduced in number, isn't reduced as much in number as you might otherwise think. Whereas the 4-inch battery, being in the superstructure with that amidships Q turret, has to be split into two smaller concentrations. The interesting thing, of course, is if you had some kind of smaller gun, whether it be a 4.5 or 5.5 inch, and then you get to the Queen Elizabeths and Revenges, which of course don't have an amidships turret, just how many you could fit along the amidship superstructure of one of those if you were still with the lighter gun. And while we're on the subject, this is kind of why, when you look at things like my proposed improvement to the Bismarcks, although ideally I'd like them to put a 127mm dual-purpose armament on in place of the 150s and the 105s, if you can't have that, I would default to a much larger 105mm armament, because in that case, because of the changes in ability to fire quickly and the range capability and obviously fire control systems, etc., by World War II, a German 105mm gun can actually range out well beyond the capability of anything that's not a Shimokaze to make a torpedo attack. And yeah, the 150 can shoot even further, but they can both outrange a destroyer's ability to fire its torpedoes, and the rate of fire difference between a German 150 and a German 105 is considerably greater than the difference between a British 4-inch and a British 6-inch in World War I, which, combined with the larger number of guns you could get, makes a Bismarck armed with all 105mm for its secondary, although not ideal, as said, I think a far superior choice, but it's for different reasons to why you might choose a lighter secondary battery in World War I. Alexander Corbett asks, were US Army Air Force efforts to mine the seas between Japan and the mainland successful in fully blockading Japan and bringing them to the peace negotiations? The short answer is no, but I think it requires a little bit more explanation. Yes, the mining effort by B-29s was highly effective, and yes, it did sink a lot of ships in fairly short order. However, a lot of this has to be taken into context. First, without the US Navy efforts to conquer the Marianas and places like Okinawa, Iwo Jima, etc., the B-29s wouldn't have had air bases from which to conduct these mining operations, whereas submarines could operate from far, far longer distances away from the Japanese home islands and still show up off the home islands and blow up Japanese shipping. So the fact the B-29s were even able to be there was actually in part thanks to the US Navy. Secondly, while again not saying that the B-29s weren't effective, they were not responsible for full blockading Japan, because there were still efforts by more direct air assaults, surface ships, and of course submarines going on. So they were all claiming their toll. And on top of all of that, you've got to factor in that those other efforts, which had not entirely, but very largely wiped out the Imperial Japanese Navy and a good chunk of its experienced sailors beforehand, meant that, for example, conducting extensive minesweeping operations was a heck of a lot more difficult with a smaller number of ships and less experienced overall crews in 1945 than it would have been in, say, 1942. And the last thing to consider in that vein is what kind of ship is being sunk. Because this is end stage of the war, lots of directly off the coast of Japan operations, but that also means that the kind of ships that can be sunk are more often than not going to be fairly small coastal ships. So you can sink a lot of them, but there will be a lot more of them still around. So if you look at the average displacement of a ship sunk by the B-29 mining effort, it actually averages out at only 1,800 tons. So obviously there would be some bigger ships sunk, but an awful lot of them are going to be really small coastal ships, which, as I said, there's quite a lot of. Whereas if you look at the submarine effort by the US Navy, that has an average displacement per ship sunk of just over 4,000 tons. So more than double. So statistically, a US Navy submarine is more likely to sink a bigger cargo vessel with considerably more cargo on board and much more important to the Japanese war effort in terms of getting supplies from various other Japanese holdings than the mines are, although obviously submarines could sink small ships and mines might occasionally sink a bigger one. But in the end, although a prolonged blockade of Japan might eventually have forced them to their knees through mass starvation, the simple fact is that even the combined efforts of the US Navy surface forces, subsurface forces, and aircraft, and the United States Army Air Force's mining efforts, and the USAF's carpet bombing and firebombing efforts, and the threat of invasion, all of that wasn't enough to bring Japan to the negotiating table. And even the first atomic bomb didn't bring them to the negotiating table. It took a demonstration of the fact that the US Air Force could repeatedly wipe out cities with atomic bombs that finally forced the Japanese to consider peace on the terms that the Allies would accept. And even then, elements of the Japanese armed forces tried to overthrow the government and keep the fight going. So, yeah, the mining effort by the US Air Force, while, as I said, very effective and definitely a key part of Allied operations, in and of itself, on its own, was never going to bring the Japanese to the negotiating table in any way, state or form that we would actually recognize as the Japanese nation. Shadow Wolf asks, is it known why the triple turrets meant for HMS Hood weren't developed in time for it to be built? Was it because of a problem in the design that was taking longer than expected to solve, or something else? Triple turrets have an on-again, off-again relationship with the Royal Navy in the run-up to and during World War I, because, of course, they're looking at triple 12-inch back with the Bellerophon and St. Vincent period designs, and then it goes away again, then it kind of comes back just of kind of for a little consideration with the Queen Elizabeth, but is very strongly considered for the Revenge class, and then goes away again, and then comes up midway through design as a discussion point for Hood. The idea of doing four triples instead of four twins is discussed. They decide it's going to add far too much weight. Then they think about, well, maybe we do triples with twin super firing over, kind of like the Nevada layout. And they decide it's probably adding a bit too much weight as well, plus the awkwardness of having two separate turret designs and therefore less interchangeable parts. And they also look at a three triple instead of four twin setup. But they decide, interestingly, that the only thing pretty much which is a roadblock to Hood having three triples instead of four twins is that, because they're considering this at a relatively advanced stage in the design process, the larger barbettes and larger magazines you would need per turret mean that, because there are certain safety margins, if you don't want the magazines too close to the outside of the hull, therefore you have a fixed volume, you would only be able to have 80 rounds per gun for a triple turret, as opposed to the 120 rounds per gun, which is what they wanted as the new standard. And at that point, they said, well, you know what? We therefore can't adopt triple turrets on Hood without completely redesigning the hull, and we don't want to do that because we're too far ahead. Whereas perhaps if they had looked at triple turrets right from the start of at least the conception of Hood as a battlecruiser, as opposed to a very, very, very early conception as some kind of shallow draft Queen Elizabeth, they might have given the hull a little bit more beam, probably made the ship overall a little bit larger as well, in order to either accommodate triple turrets with 120 rounds per gun, or very generously accommodate twin turrets. And the thing was that triple turrets weren't beyond the ability of British manufacturers to make, because Vickers had been both directly selling and offering for sale triple turret designs all the way back from the 12-inch era. They knew how to build one. It was just the Royal Navy never ordered one until they were looking at the G3s, N3s, and then obviously eventually the Nelsons for its capital ships. One of the other things which is quite interesting looking through the history of the triple turret in that period for the Royal Navy is that there's a constant argument that pops up, which is that thanks to the Royal Navy's habit of jumping capital ship gun sizes by about an inch and a half, it just so happens that if you're using approximately similar levels of armor protection on twins and triples, and you're using obviously the same gun, just two or three of them, it turns out that approximately speaking, the weight of a triple of your previous gun caliber is roughly the same as the weight of a twin of the next caliber up. So a triple 12-inch turret, for example, would weigh about as much as a twin 13.5. A triple 13.5 would weigh about as much as a twin 15, and a triple 15 would weigh about as much as a twin 16.5, and a twin 16 would be slightly less. The 16.5 inch was a caliber that the Royal Navy briefly flirted with in the late 1910s and early 1920s. And then whenever that came up, people would go, well, you know, instead of going for the, as yet, because they never implemented it till the Nelsons, unproven triple turret, if we're going to accommodate that much extra weight in the ship, why don't we just give it bigger guns with longer range and more hitting power for the same weight? And that kind of usually tended to kill off discussions. Personally, I think triple turrets would have been a good idea for the Royal Navy, but then I have my own whole little triple turret universe, which is derived from the either the Bellerophons or the St. Vincents being done with three triples amid on the center line, and then that all leading to both prevalent triple turrets and a lot of all forward designs going all the way down the timeline, all the way to the 1940s. So maybe I'll talk about that at some point in the future, but who knows. Vonti RTS asks, could you give a brief history of Carrier Air Group 15 aboard USS Essex? I met a guy the other day whose grandfather served aboard her during the Battle of Leyte Gulf and earned both a Navy Cross and a Distinguished Flying Cross. I was hoping to know a bit more about them. Well, you're in luck, because there has actually been a reasonable amount written about them. Partially, you'll understand why in a minute when I tell you a bit more. But if you want to know considerably more about them, there is a book called Fabled 15, The Pacific War Saga of Carrier Air Group 15, which you can get, and obviously is going to have a lot more information than I can impart to you in the next 4.5 to 5 minutes. Nonetheless, Carrier Air Group 15 was aboard USS Essex from May to November 1944, relieving Carrier Air Group 9, and this picture, taken on the 14th of May 1944, actually shows Essex deploying with the aircraft of Carrier Air Group 15 aboard, plus some extras that it was taking out to supplement other carriers as well. But the whole thing would obviously be curtailed towards the end of November 1944, when the ship was hit by a kamikaze and had to go back, and then it was cycled out for a new air group. Now, that period, only 7 months, saw Carrier Air Group 15 achieve some quite amazing statistics. They shot down an awful lot of aircraft, they sank an awful lot of shipping. They became one of, if not the most successful carrier air groups of the Pacific War, but they did pay for it as well. So in the early weeks of their deployment, they were actually noted as being quite brash and quite overconfident. Essex's captain took them on what he described as a training raid to go and shoot up Marcus Island and Wake Island, both of which had been bypassed. The Japanese still held them, and as I've said before, they're pretty much being used by the US Navy as free live fire exercise areas for carriers that were heading out to the actual front line. And he essentially said, yeah, you know, well, they're really, really enthusiastic, perhaps a little too much, because half the aircraft came back with damage from anti-aircraft guns, so they were perhaps going in a little bit too hard and a little bit too low. But they seem to have wised up fairly quickly, and they would go on to participate in the Battle of the Philippine Sea, the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, and the Battle of Leyte Gulf. And at Leyte Gulf, they actually ended up in two separate engagements, Sibuyan Sea, where they landed major hits on the Musashi, and then later on against the Japanese carriers at the Battle of Cape Engano. And that's just the two major actions. They obviously took part in a lot of smaller actions, although as the book and various articles that were published closer to the time note, while they can be credited with a core of aircraft shot down and a core of ships sunk and damaged, it's very difficult to establish exactly how much damage they did to the Japanese war machine, because, of course, quite a lot of targets were being engaged by multiple carrier air groups, including, for example, Musashi. So who exactly landed the fatal blow on Musashi? It's difficult to tell. It's a shared credit situation. At one point, they're credited with shooting down just over 60 aircraft in one day. That would be VF-15, the fighter squadron. And that, I think, still makes them the single highest scoring fighter squadron of all time for the US Navy. And you also have other situations they became quite well known for. For example, during the Battle of the Philippine Sea, obviously the fighters were sent off first when the Japanese airstrikes were detected as incoming, but then the Helldivers and the Avengers were sent off in large part just to keep them away from the aircraft carrier, because then if a strike came in and hit the Essex, well, if you didn't have fueled and armed aircraft aboard, the damage would be considerably less. They weren't expected to intercept Japanese attackers. They were just supposed to orbit somewhere nearby and stay out of the way. But they decided, well, while we're up here and fully armed, we might as well go and blow up some nearby Japanese airfields. So they did. Again, it cost them a couple of aircraft, but it was a good show of initiative. And as we know from the Battle of the Philippine Sea, generally US carrier air groups did hit quite a lot of the Japanese airfields, which made it very difficult for the Japanese strategy of launching an extreme range, then landing back at land-based airfields and then returning to their carriers, much harder to carry out. But as I said at the beginning, they did pay something of a heavy price for all of this. They started out with a strength of 100 pilots, so slightly more than would be flown off at any one time. But by the time their seven-month deployment finished, they'd lost 43 pilots killed in action or missing, and another 12 had been wounded, along with 29 killed or missing crewmen on the Helldivers and the Avengers, and another 13 wounded. Aircraft losses in and of themselves were somewhat less of a concern, because aircraft can always be replaced. Whereas pilots and crews could be replaced in terms of keeping the air group on the front lines, but you can't bring back the people that you've lost. But they were, all things considered, a very effective and very hard-hitting group. So, I'd recommend, if you want to know more about them, see that book I mentioned earlier. Lars611Farmer3 asks, my question is about the sequence from 1741 to 1751 in the Admiral Spruance video. Are these sailors spraying the barrels of a 5-inch 38 mount to cool them down after rapid fire? You can see steam emerging from the barrels. And if yes, isn't there a risk of warping the barrels by doing this, which might degrade the gun's accuracy? Well, here's the sequence in question. It's just going to repeat while we're answering it. So, yes, they are spraying hoses on this 5-inch 38 mount. However, while I don't know the exact circumstances behind this, and while spraying guns with water to cool them down, it was definitely a thing that was done in the Second World War, I think in this particular case, something a little bit more dramatic has happened with this particular gun mounting. Now, usually, spraying large amounts of cold water onto a gun has a theoretical possibility that it might warp the gun barrel. But realistically speaking, given the thermal capacity of even a 5-inch gun, let alone anything bigger, versus the amount of cooling that a single hose can do, the risk of warpage is very, very, very low. However, in this case, there is still, some fairly rapid cooling going on, particularly when they spray the left-hand gun in the gun mount, but the right-hand gun from our perspective, you can actually see large amounts of what's probably paint flaking off all of a sudden under the hose. And that will either be because the paint has come loose, it's been heated and come loose by the guns firing quite a lot, or probably more likely, the sudden rapid cooling of the gun has resulted, obviously, in the gun shrinking ever so slightly, which has then popped the paint off, one of the two. But the reason why I think in this particular case maybe something has gone a little bit wrong with this mounting is that if you look at when they're spraying down the left-hand gun, they're not just spraying down the two guns to cool them down. And you can see, obviously, the steam coming off the right-hand one in the picture. But the left-hand one doesn't seem to be steaming as much, and they are actually spraying that hose directly down the mouth of the gun, which is not standard practice. That could, under normal circumstances, potentially do something a bit screwy with the bore of the gun, the liner, etc. That's not normal. And then you can see, obviously, the water then coming out of the gun afterwards. So while it is, I suppose, possible that this is after action, because you'll note the Oerlikon 20mm there is not manned. You can see a bunch of expended shell casings down there on the bottom right, and there's some interested observers. So that makes me think this is after action, because if they were still in action, probably that 20mm would be manned, and you'd probably be seeing additional 5-inch casings being added to that pile from other gun mountings. So I think maybe what's happened here is maybe there's been a hang fire, a misfire, a shell detonating early, or something has gone wrong with this mount, and they are therefore doing a kind of emergency cool-off for whatever reason. I mean, it was possible that it was firing far too fast, and that in and of itself has caused stuff to become jammed in it, and perhaps to prevent a cook-off, they're very rapidly hosing it down to drop the temperature enough so that someone can eventually figure out how to extract either the stuck shell, potentially stuck shells. Incidentally, by the way, when you see the US archive footage in the Spruance videos and in pretty much any other video of the kind of that I do, that footage is directly related to what I am talking about at the time. It's not just randomly selected. So in this case, you know, where that video is talking about all the way up to the Battle of the Philippine Sea from the Marianas. So the part of Spruance's career and the Pacific campaign that I'm talking about, this footage is noted by the US National Archives as having come from that particular operation. So likewise with the more recent Spruance video, when I'm talking about Iwo Jima, you're seeing footage from the Iwo Jima operations. When I'm talking about Okinawa, you're seeing footage from the Okinawa operations, and similarly Saipan, Tinian, Guam. Every time I'm talking about those operations, that is footage from that particular operation, rather than just, hey, here's a bunch of stuff randomly chosen from the Pacific War. Vicky asks a two-part question. Firstly, when confronted with the problem of Type 93 torpedoes being too large for their submarine designs to use, why did the Imperial Japanese Navy develop smaller long lances instead of bigger submarines? They were far from averse to giant submarines as it was. And secondly, why did the Porters and Summerses use single-purpose 5-inch 38s rather than the quick-firing version of the 5-inch 51, given that the 5-inch 38 had inferior long-range ballistics against surface targets and the lack of need for a surface action-only turret to elevate and train anywhere near as rapidly as a dual-purpose turret? With the torpedoes, basically the square cube law comes in clutch on this one, because you might think, well, 21 to 24 and a half inches, that's not a huge amount. And you'd be right. That's 3.5 inches. Okay, if you've got pairs of torpedo launchers, it's, 7 inches. However will we survive having to either make our pressure hull 7 inches wider or just spreading the torpedo tube launchers out a little bit more? That isn't so much the problem. The much, much larger problem is all the stuff that comes from that. So the Type 95, the submarine-launched 21-inch version, is just a fraction over 7 meters long. So we're talking about now the length as opposed to the breadth increase. The Type 93, the long lance, is 9 meters long. So it's almost 2 meters longer. Now, that means that if we take, for example, a Japanese Type B submarine, those things are pretty big already. You know, they're cruiser subs, over 2,500 tons surface displacement, almost 4,000 tons submerged. And using the 21-inch version, they have 6 bow tubes and near enough as makes no difference, two full sets of reloads. And if you've ever been inside a museum sub, you'll tend to know that those reloads tend to be stacked one behind the other. So you're talking essentially about the tubes plus two torpedoes going backwards. And usually, they, you know, if you've got six, so you'd have six and then another six sitting behind, roughly speaking. Now, that means that if we ignore the diameter for a second, say, okay, well, the submarine might just be a little bit more cramped, but we'll live with that. You're talking about the launch tube being roughly about 2 meters longer. And then the space for the first set of reloads is adding another 2 meters. And then the space for the second set of reloads is adding another 2 meters. So you've now added 6 meters or 18 to 20 feet to the submarine. So you're adding about 6% to the total length of an already very large submarine just to accommodate the physical length of carrying full-size long lances as opposed to Type 95s. But that's not all, because, of course, if you increase the pressure hull length by that much, then you've got to include more ballast tanks, stronger pumps, more compressed air reserves, because now you've got more displacement. You're going to have to completely rebalance the sub design because it's now going to be a little bit nose heavy. You've also got to redo the hull lines, the outer casing. And all of that is going to add additional weight, additional complexity, additional cost. It might also mean that your submarine might become slower to dive, which isn't necessarily a good thing for survival. And honestly, even a Model 1 Type 95 is already carrying enough explosive charge to defeat almost every torpedo defense system out there, with the theoretical exclusion of the King George V's, which are designed against a 1,000-pound TNT equivalent warhead. But if you've got one of the later models, they carry enough to blow through even that. So yeah, having a bit of extra explosive, as you would find in a full-size long lance, that would kill things even more efficiently. But the Type 95, the 21-inch version, is going to still kill things fairly well. And one of the other big advantages of the long lance is the ridiculous range that it has, but that is far less useful on a submarine than it is on a surface ship, because, well, a submarine is first supposed to get much closer and much sneakier, but also there's some question as to whether a submarine can even establish a half-decent fire control solution using late 30s submarine fire control technology at anything like the additional range advantage that you'd get using a long lance, because, well, again, the Type 95... assuming you set it to its, you know, relatively pedestrian 45 knots or more on the baseline model slow mode, that's still over 13,000 yards range. You're extremely unlikely to be able to get a valid fire control solution at that range. So the fact that the full-sized long lance can go absolutely ridiculously further really is irrelevant, because you wouldn't probably even know there was a ship out there at that kind of range, let alone be able to get a half-decent fire control solution for it. But then we also come to the other big aspect of this, which is weight. And here the square cube law is really biting, because the Type 95 is about 1.7 tons. The Type 93, the long lance, is 2.7 tons. So it's almost 60% heavier than the Type 95. And that's going to pose some real problems, because moving a 1.7 ton torpedo around in a confined environment like a submarine is going to be interesting, but it could be done. Moving a 2.7 ton torpedo around in that same environment, I don't envy anyone who has to do that without significant power assistance. And if you're going to have significant power assistance, then that's additional weight, additional space, and your submarine's got even larger. And now you are not so much cruiser submarine by role, you're probably cruiser submarine by size and displacement as well, and the associated costs and dive time limitations, etc., etc. So, yeah, basically, the long lance only really offers more boom where the Type 95 already has quite a lot of boom for most circumstances, and then offers up a laundry list of issues that you'd have to overcome, at which point it's just better to invent the 21-inch and go with that. Plus, of course, you've got the other thing, which is that prior to the invention of the Long Lance, all your submarines that have been built before that have 21-inch torpedoes. So if you invent a 21-inch version, the Type 95, you can, in theory, hopefully, retrofit the Type 95 into older submarines. If you build a gargantuan sub that can fire long lances, you can't retrofit the older submarines with an improved torpedo, unless you separately develop the Type 95 anyway. As far as the Porters and Summerses, there are two big advantages that the 5-inch 38 has, especially as a destroyer gun, compared to sticking the 5-inch 51 on. Firstly, bear in mind these are built under treaty restrictions, and the 5-inch 51 weighs more than double what a 5-inch 38 does. Now, admittedly, you're talking about just under 2 tonnes, or around about 2 tonnes for a 5-inch 38 versus a little bit over 5 tonnes for a 5-inch 51, so you might not think that adds up to all that much, but when you're talking about roughly 3 tonnes, multiply by the 8 guns, and suddenly you're looking at 24 additional tons. Again, doesn't sound like much, but in terms of destroyer design, that's a huge amount, especially when you consider that's the gun only, not including the obviously significantly stronger trunnion supports and elevating gear, etc., that you would need to support and move around such a heavier gun. So you're probably actually looking more like adding 50 to 75 tons, maybe more, to the overall design. That's a lot of weight to add to a treaty destroyer design, especially high up. The other element, apart from different ammunition types, which is also a thing, but perhaps a far more important element, is barrel life. Now, we're used to battleships having a decent barrel life at around 250, 300, maybe 400 rounds per gun. Destroyers are a completely different kettle of fish. Because based on battleship gun wear rates, you might think a destroyer's gun that can last 900 rounds is really good, which is what the 5-inch 51 can do. But the 5-inch 38 can last over 4,000 rounds. In fact, it's roughly speaking, the 5-inch 51 has about 20% of the barrel life of the 5-inch 38. And that could be a problem, because if you think about how many times a destroyer's gun could be expected to fire compared to a battleship's, you know, we know that a battleship, roughly speaking, is going to be firing its guns about once a minute in a relatively intense battle. And they don't take part in big battles all that often. So you could quite easily blow through your entire magazine. In fact, you know, assuming you've got more than about half your barrel life left on the average battleship gun, you would actually shoot out your entire magazine before you ran out of barrel life. Whereas on destroyers, with a 5-inch 38, you can shoot out multiple magazines and your barrel life is still fine. With a 5-inch 51, you're getting a lot closer to perhaps wearing the barrel quite significantly. In fact, you know, if you'd say gone through one very intense engagement and shot out your magazines and then you restocked your mags with a 5-inch 51 equipped destroyer, you might be looking at dangerously close to wearing out your gun barrel just fighting one more major surface action. And yeah, destroyers could be expected to fight quite a lot of surface actions compared to their battleship counterparts. So those would be the two primary reasons why they chose to stick with single-purpose 5-inch 38s, as opposed to dropping back to the theoretically per-shot better for a surface engagement 5-inch 51. Cameron asks, in the Pacific Theater, the idea of kamikazes comes up a lot, but what I'm more interested in is a lot of the time it's mentioned how effective these planes are, but I'm more curious about the physics of a plane possibly penetrating armor. We've seen accounts of ships like battleships being scared of kamikazes. So what are the physics of a plane making it through armor when so much technology went into both the armor and the armor-piercing shell? So this is quite similar to a previous question in a recent dry dock about kamikazes, but when you're talking specifically about battleships, it does afford a little bit of additional explanation. You can see here, I believe this is a kamikaze about to cause a small dent on USS Missouri. what battleships were generally concerned about was not so much a kamikaze making it through their citadel armor, because basically that wasn't going to happen. Even if the kamikaze was carrying a full armor-piercing bomb, it just wasn't going to get up to the kind of speeds necessary to even begin to threaten it, let alone impact angle and all and that kind of stuff. The problem that battleships had with kamikazes was essentially threefold. Firstly, if a battleship took enough kamikazes that a decent portion of its anti-aircraft battery was disabled, it might then be vulnerable to attack by aircraft carrying more conventional munitions like torpedo bombers, which still did appear during kamikaze attacks. And at the same time, it would not be able to defend the far more vulnerable aircraft carriers. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is sheer loss of life. I mean, you can see here, again from the shot on Missouri, just how many people were out and exposed, even in this small section of the ship, during anti-aircraft drill, or in this case, real-life, you know, anti-aircraft battle. And a kamikaze, because as we've discussed before, you know, you've got usually a semi-armored piercing or general-purpose bomb, plus the aircraft itself, including the engine block and any remaining onboard ammunition, and the fuel, is actually a very comprehensive shrapnel and incendiary weapon. And if it hits an open exposed area, like an area where there's a bunch of anti-aircraft guns, it is possible for a single kamikaze to cause significantly more casualties than you would receive if that aircraft had just dropped its bomb. Because if it dropped its bomb, yeah, assuming it hits in the same location, there would be casualties from the initial explosion, from the shrapnel, but that would be about it. Whereas when a whole aircraft hits, not only is there considerably more shrapnel, but there's also much more potential for direct kinetic strike by the wings and the bits of the aircraft as it hits, whereas a bomb is relatively small. You'd have to be stupidly unlucky to actually get physically hit by a bomb. Whereas if you've got an aircraft with a wingspan in, you know, double-digit feet hitting you, it's entirely possible that a wing could wipe out an entire anti-aircraft battery or two on its way to the aircraft making its final impact position. And then you've got the spread of the burning fuel, which is going to complicate rescuing people who are wounded, who might otherwise survive, but also that scattering of burning fuel can go further and catch even more people. So from a human perspective, kamikazes are quite worrying for a battleship, even if the watertight integrity of the ship is not really under threat. And the final element to it is, of course, in terms of damage control. Again, because of the multiple natures of damage that a kamikaze that's carrying some form of munition will inflict. Again, if we take an unarmored area like, let's say, the bow, if a bomb hits the bow, again, blast, potentially a fire from maybe some onboard flammables, if you're really unlucky, the paint locker, but that's pretty much it. Whereas a kamikaze hits, not only are a lot more compartments likely to get riddled because of the greater amounts of shrapnel, but with that fuel fire that will definitely be set off, it makes the whole damage control exercise considerably more difficult. And of course, with a prolonged source of intense heat, like a fuel fire, there is more chance for other things aboard in the immediate vicinity that might not have caught fire just because of a bomb blast to then catch fire because of the fuel fire, and the fire spreads, and therefore there is a possibility for a kamikaze to do considerably more damage than a relatively small 250 or 500 pound bomb hit in that same area would do when you're talking about battleships. A.B. Coates asks, it's said that HMS Dreadnought made all the ships that came before her obsolete. With that said, which pre-Dreadnoughts gave the best performance in the Dreadnought era? Almost certainly the Russian ones. And that's simply because, well, for the Germans, their pre-Dreadnoughts were, if anything, a drag on the high seas fleet with their insistence on coming along. For the British, after a short period in 1914, the role of British pre-dreadnoughts was largely to go and shoot up Gallipoli and to operate in secondary theatres. For the French, pretty much the same. The Americans, getting involved considerably later in the war and being an ocean away, didn't have to use their pre-dreadnoughts much at all, again for frontline duties. The Japanese got a little bit more use out of their pre-dreadnoughts, but they faced very little opposition, whereas the Russians in both the Baltic and Black Seas were facing modern dreadnought opposition, ironically both German-designed, because Goeben was down in the Black Sea. And the Russians, with relatively few dreadnoughts of their own, and in some cases none initially at the outbreak of war, especially in, again, the Black Sea, had to improvise quite a lot with their remaining pre-dreadnoughts after the Battle of Tsushima and so forth. And that meant, so when you got the German Operation Albion in the Baltic, it was mostly pre-dreadnoughts that were providing the bulk of the anti-German battleship and battlecruiser gunfire and doing a relatively decent job of it. And then, of course, you have the Voltron-like assembly of Russian pre-dreadnoughts in the Black Sea, which managed to see off the Goeben. So in terms of actual practical results, it's got to be the Russians. Rebel Skvirl asks, assuming the fleet Aerom had remained under Royal Navy control rather than being put under the RAF during the interwar years, how much of a difference would it have made as the Royal Navy entered and then fought World War II? It has two potentially major implications. Firstly is that during the interwar period, if the Fleet Aerom is its own separate thing and the budget for the Royal Navy is being increased to compensate for that rather than going to the RAF, then it is highly likely that the Royal Navy is getting more specialised aircraft and is actually getting aircraft roughly when it wants them, rather than being, let's be honest, most of the time somewhat near the bottom end of the priority in terms of aircraft construction and development contracts. And if you've got better aircraft, then you can make better use of them, which perhaps will advance Royal Navy tactics somewhat, and will also mean that the aircraft that they enter the war with are somewhat more specialised to the role that the Royal Navy wants. Now, of course, they were getting aircraft more specialised towards the role that they wanted towards the very end of the 1930s, but that's very different from suddenly being given control to a certain degree and being able to build on a bunch of other aircraft from before. The other element would be in terms of the aircraft that were actually under development at the start of World War II. It's possible that those aircraft might be advanced a little bit, so the properly dedicated and modified Seafire, like you see a potential drawing of here, might have actually been in the process of construction, so it'd be much harder for the Royal Air Force to then steal all the Merlin engines for their own purposes. But again, in reference to having better control, there may have actually developed separate lines of naval aircraft equipment in bulk rather than the relatively minor separated lines that you get historically. And thus, in the case of our potential fully adapted Seafire in 1939 or 1940, it may be that it's not using a Merlin engine, because, yeah, the RAF may still manage to finagle getting full control of that production line, but there might be a fully developed line of marine-adapted high-performance engines which the Royal Navy could fall back on and say, well, look, we're going to use these because, realistically, they're going to cost slightly more than the land-based versions, and therefore the RAF has no particular use for them, so we can still stick those in our aircraft and get high-performance aircraft from the get-go. Nathan P. Gillespie asks, what would 14-year-old Drac think if you could tell him about naval history, travel, and writing? I think that he would think that, thank goodness, there's a way of earning a living that doesn't involve going into a soul-crushing office full of mostly room-temperature IQs and huge amounts of office and actual politics. Albeit that if I was able to time travel and tell 14-year-old Drac all about what I do now, I think I would probably still tell him to do the engineering degree and maybe the first half decade or so in engineering, mostly because that helps round out the engineering side of what I know, and that is actually a huge, huge help. But then, roughly speaking, come the shenanigans that come around with the credit crunch or the depression or whatever you want to call it, the great financial kerfuffle that lasted from about 2008 through 2013, I think at that point I would tell him, when you get to that point and you're dealing with some really obnoxious people, that's the point you should probably just quit and go into doing naval history full time. And of course, knowing that, you could invest even more time in doing naval history full research and so forth before you get to that the split point. The Outer Circle asks, with the advent of armoured warships in the Opium Wars and their successes, followed by the absolute failures of some of said armour in colder European waters, what metallurgical response took place? How was this investigated, as this was early days of metallurgy and all common tensile, ductile and hardness levels, etc., that we perform on modern steels and structural members were still being figured out? I guess I am asking, how did the field develop in response to the fluctuations in armour due to climate? Initially, there was a lot of confusion and a lot of guesswork, and to a certain extent, a degree of Victorian practicality, because the vast majority of designers and armour manufacturers looked at the situation and went, that's weird. We don't necessarily understand, or depending on their level of expertise, fully understand exactly why this has occurred. However, what we can do is deal with the consequences. So, you know, iron, regardless of whether it was behaving in a brittle or a ductile fashion, was still fairly good at robbing the energy from incoming projectiles and still pretty good at stopping shells. So its value as an armor material was still there. The problem, as we mentioned, was obviously the splinters when it was behaving in a brittle fashion. So they just went, okay, we'll just stick a bunch of wood behind it to absorb the splinters. It's not as ideal as just having armor plating, because obviously that would save weight and space. But it's still considerably better than what we had before, which was just pure wood. So we'll go with that and we'll figure out exactly why this happened later on, rather than getting bogged down with the intricate details of trying to essentially restore the original solution when they didn't have the full knowledge. But a number of scientists did begin to comprehend what was going on in a way that we would understand it now. One of the bigger problems they actually faced was the continuing advancement of metallurgy, because if you look at some of the more modern tests that have been done on various bits of surviving iron from the period, whether it be iron from the SS Great Britain or iron from HMS Warrior or a few other surviving ironclads, what you actually see in those tests is that the exact mixture of elements in the iron and the way and the quality in which it was made are constantly evolving and mostly, to be fair, getting better. But what that meant is that the transition point between ductile and brittle behavior was constantly moving. So if you actually sat down and did a series of objective tests, by the time you'd finished them, you'd gone, hey, look, guys, the iron that's being used in shipmaking reacts in this way at this temperature, and then it changes at this temperature, so this is what we need to investigate more closely. Well, then when you went to try and do that same kind of practical experiment, so repeat the experiment to get more data points on, let's say, the armour that's being used on HMS Northumberland being launched here, you'd get completely different results, and you think, okay, was my experiment wrong? Well, actually, it turns out it's just HMS Northumberland is using much better quality iron than Warrior was using, which in turn was using much better quality iron than the Great Britain was using, and so on and so on and so forth. And some of those advances in and of themselves actually mitigated a good chunk of the problems. And then you get into compound armor and steel. So essentially, the metallurgical analysis field was desperately trying to catch up, and the field of metallurgy in terms of development of new and improved forms of iron and then steel was actually running away from them. They did eventually catch up and realise what the problem was, but by the time they did, it was far too late for iron armour generally. Captain Oblivious asks, I was looking at a wide variety of World War II carrier pictures, mainly American, when I happened to notice that although most of the time when a carrier is underway, aircraft are parked near the stern, in many of the photos they're parked near the bow. What dictated bow versus stern parking? Perhaps aircraft are incoming and bow parking allows them to land? Would that be the only reason? So if there are aircraft visible on deck in a World War II carrier context, you'll usually see them in one of three contexts, either some aircraft at the stern, some aircraft at the bow, or aircraft everywhere like this. If you see aircraft all over the place in this manner, that will usually mean one of two things. Either the aircraft or the carrier is acting as an aircraft ferry, so the aircraft that you'll see on deck are largely in addition to her own air group, and they're going to be flown off to go off to, you know, Malta, North Africa, various island bases in the Pacific, etc., etc. And there'll usually, therefore, be a small gap at the bow to allow those initial aircraft to take off, usually fighters. The other alternative, which is most likely what you're seeing here with Enterprise just before World War II, is the ship has just sailed, so it's heading out on a deployment, and usually that means a huge amount of stores have been brought on board, but perhaps have not been fully stowed away, and so they have been stashed in the hangar, and therefore the aircraft don't have room in the hangar, and therefore this allows the ship to sail while all those stores are still being stashed away. You just put all the aircraft up on the flight deck and hope you don't run into a storm in the next couple of days. And then as the stores are stashed and space opens up, then aircraft can be put below. There is also the tertiary thing of it might just be to show off to the local civilians as the ship sails. Once you're in a combat area, then the most likely area for aircraft to be is at the stern, because that'll be ready to go aircraft, usually combat air patrol aircraft, but occasionally some strike aircraft as well. And that's the most common picture that you'll see. But in terms of aircraft being parked near the bow on the stern and amidships being clear, yes, that will be specifically to allow aircraft to come in to land. And the aircraft you're seeing at the bow usually will be aircraft that have already landed, and there just hasn't been a slot in the elevator or the lift to take them back down into the hangar. Although, depending on exactly where they're positioned, they may also be a small force of combat air patrol aircraft ready to go in case enemy aircraft show up. And that's because there's multiple systems of barriers. You can actually see here in this picture, right up near the bow, you've got a windbreak to stop aircraft being blown about. But further back, around the level of the island, you would, and exactly where depends on the class of carrier, you would have one or more crash barriers. And as the name suggests, those are designed to catch aircraft that fail to engage with the cabling or for whatever other reason are not going to stop in time. And in theory, anything forward of that area should be safe. So one of the ways to tell exactly what's going on would be to look at exactly where those aircraft are positioned on the bow. If they're right up front in the area that in this picture is clear, those are aircraft that are waiting to be struck below. If there's a handful of aircraft, you know, halfway back from the bow to the island or two-thirds of the way back, and then a little bit of space, those will be most likely aircraft ready to go at a moment's notice, ahead of the crash barriers, but with enough room forward for takeoff. And finally for this week, if the gods wanted us to be happy, they would have given us a honey-based alcoholic beverage. Oh Look Mead asks, between 1910 and 1922, can you choose 3 to 5 ships, either built during that time or modernized in that period, which you would save from the breaker's yard, based on engineering grounds? Either because they're the first successful attempt at that type of ship, they're an archetypical version of that kind of ship, or they're the peak of that kind of ship. My top 3 ships that were built in that period and actually survived long enough to go to the scrappers as opposed to ships destroyed, because there are a few that were sunk that I would probably prefer to keep. But anyway, you'd be looking at HMS Agincourt, because she's a 12-inch gunned dreadnought. She has those ridiculous amount of turrets. And, of course, she was foreign built, but then into the Royal Navy, and therefore covers a lot of different bases in terms of history. Then I would save Ise, mostly because she's built in this time period, but by the time she went to the breakers, she was in this hybrid carrier format, which again would be a very interesting bit of naval history, even if it wasn't a particularly good bit to be preserved. And then lastly would be the Goeben, because, well, she'd be the only example of a German dreadnought-type vessel, the only battle cruiser, and let's face it, she did her time with the Turkish Navy. She deserved to stick around. And that brings us to the end of the dry dock for this week. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Next week is, of course, the Patreon dry dock, so there'll be a lot of questions answered there. It's February, shortest month of the year. And with all that said, see you again in another video.